educator, world explorer, and an artist who works in clay, all joyously celebrated equally. We'll be right back. Hello, this is Stephen DeLuque, and you are tuned in to KCBX Public Radio, representing the California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. This program is Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program that explores and enhances the understanding and appreciation of the visual arts. Today's guest is the second half of a dialogue co-host Krissa Hewitt and I had with one of our local luminaries, Bob Nichols. Bob has been producing pottery in the area since the early 70s and teaching for nearly as long. His journey has taken him to Alaska, where he met his wife, Jana, and to Niger in Central Africa, where he visited with his daughter, who was with the Peace Corps. We join Bob as he explains the process of becoming an instructor and the sacrifices of pursuing a graduate degree.
I was hired at Hancock on having the equivalent of a master's degree in experience, but only being paid on a bachelor's degree pay scale meant that there was a great deal of opportunity to change our income, and I was qualified to apply for sabbatical leave. So I went down to UCSB and I talked to Michael Arns, and basically he said, go ahead and apply, you're fine, you'll be in. And so went into the Master of Fine Arts degree in the Department of Art Studio at UCSB, a two-year program. And so for the first quarter, fall quarter, I was teaching full-time and driving down at night to participate in the seminars. And I took spring semester for my sabbatical and went in residence, found a place I could live inexpensively, and spent whatever those 12 or 14 weeks, the next two quarters, seemed like it was longer than that, in residence, occasionally coming home on the weekends. My second year in the graduate program, I was working full-time at Hancock and doing all that one can imagine about leaving at 5 and getting down in time for the 7 o'clock seminar and driving back and forth, and then they called from Poly and asked me to teach 3D design, so what the heck, this would be really crazy.
Yeah, spare time.
The equivalent of the Boston subway system, that old folk song, and Jana would meet me out here at the Marsh Street exit and hand me my lunch on the way by kind of deal. I had reached the point in January of the second year of the program, and I was downstairs writing a paper for a seminar. And Jana came down and said, how are you doing? I said, I'm not a very good graduate student. I'm not a very good teacher right now. And I'm not a very good husband or a very good father. I'm not sure this is worth it. And she just looks at me and said, you can do anything for 22 weeks. What a gift. It was mm-hmm. this paradigm shift. But it gave me a peace of mind to go ahead and get the project mm-hmm. And the work finished, and it worked out really well, and the pay increase was worth the effort. I say all that as a foundation for what happened to me, because when I went into the graduate program, I had no confidence that I had any art in me. I had been a studio potter. The first thing they gave me to teach at Hancock was art appreciation. And I know for the first two semesters, I was teaching about a page and a half ahead of my students. And after 3 years of teaching the course, I really realized where my experience was strong and where the experience was weak and where I needed to keep studying to be better at that. So I arrive in the graduate program at UCSB, and eventually they say, well, define your studio practice. How do you function as an artist? How? What do you mean? And so part of that was a lot of reflection. Another thing was beginning to feel a need to step aside from my wonderful interest in cultures from around the world and find my own set of symbols to work with. One of the ones that became really valuable to me was the notion of the vessel. In this case, I'm talking about the boat. But I love the play on words, that the vessel is container, the vessel is transportation, the vessel is a vehicle for new world experiences. And when I was in Mexico last month, was challenging myself to do that again, and was finding myself with the boat is still really important to me, the vessel idea, but also hands, heart, and passion, and ways to integrate those symbolically into the work. And that all ties back into how I can be a more effective teacher by showing students that being in love with the material and the process gets you only so far. And at some point, the work has to become owned by the individual. The work has to be about their passion, about their lives. And so trying to figure out ways to help people discover their work is a fascinating challenge, and one that I have embraced with mixed feelings about how much energy it takes from me to get them to be open to the possibilities of being truly creative beyond material.
It was all too easy to set up assignments that could be very predictable in their results. I always hoped that I could make a suggestion that would spark something in them.
Do you find it difficult to motivate young artists? I find a lot of the younger people especially have so much self-censorship involved in how they create that it's difficult to kind of break that down and just say, no, really, do what you want to do. Just, you know, let yourself go.
It's a really interesting question in the sense that permission is a big issue. And I think it's an incredibly important issue right now because we've adopted a set of guidelines for K-12 education which have shifted away from the classic kind of liberal arts, broad spectrum education to we need you to be able to demonstrate mastery of a series of concepts. And all the K-12 teachers that I'm talking to are just pulling their hair out because most of the enjoyment of their teaching experience that has to do with opening those doors has been stripped away from them. And now they not only do they have to cover material on a day-by-day basis, they also have to watch the students come back with acceptable score levels or evaluations are threatened and income for the school is threatened.
The student is product, and I think that's something that's really shifted dramatically in a wrong direction in the last 10 years. It's just like we aren't producing free-thinking, analyzing young people anymore. We're producing a product that can pass exams. And I think that's really sad.
It's going to shift. It's a pendulum or a sinusoidal wave kind of pattern. But it's been really gratifying to hear several of our local legislators speaking in Sacramento about one-size-fits-all education doesn't work. And we've given up on vocational training and a number of issues, and they're beginning to say, whoa, maybe we're... So I'm sensing there'll be a shift. But the arts, in the face of economic uncertainty, are typically one of the places that are drawn down most significantly. What I'm concerned about is students who arrive in my classroom who are now of a tell-me-what-to-do-to-get-an-A mindset. And so step one is your high-powered motivation to get an A is really misplaced. Mm-hmm. Your high-powered motivation really ought to be what do you learn, how do you think. And so in the arts, I feel great freedom in the classroom because I can talk about geophysics, plate tectonics, the chemistry of clay, the formation of earth forms, all of the things that lead to that answered my questions that weren't answered for me while I was in college and have done since, or where do our glaze materials come from? And what I was doing in Mexico last month, where I was gathering clay from local potters to bring back and experiment with, but also to be able to show my students their work and the raw material and talk about this whole phenomena. I give assignments that are technique-based and philosophically oriented. So here's a pinch pot, the basic, simplest forms of taking a piece of clay and shaping it, and yet there'll be amongst the 30 students in the room 30 variations on that theme. But they all look like little bowls, and that's fine. But then I ask them to think about transforming that bowl to the magic of their own touch. And Pinchpot's Magic and Ritual is the name of the assignment. And so they're supposed to use techniques of joining clay and adding other elements. And I tell them stories about cultures that serve their communities and about begging bowls is a terrible term, but places where the monks walk in the community with these brass bowls, and the community's responsibility is to feed the monks. Mm-hmm. And that notion of engagement. When I worked alone in the studio, I did enjoy some level of unexpected social contact, and it was not unusual around 3 or 4 in the afternoon, somebody would stop by for a cup of tea. And I'd pull out a little bowl and put some raisins and almonds or apricots in the bowl. And that act of generosity, that act of being able to share with another person, transformed, you know, you put the bag of apricots on the table, it would be just the same thing functionally, but...
Not really, though.
Well, I agree. That's why I certainly... my point.
No, Ziploc bags don't act the same thing as a bowl of nuts and fruit.
So the whole issue is how to help folks enjoy the experience of not being trapped in those expectations of in a final evaluation. You were all born with the promise of 24 hours a day. And you will, as we all do, spend every one of those 24 hours and all of the increments of those 24 hours and the minutes and moments doing exactly that which is most important to you, which includes doing things you really don't want to do because you'd rather do something else to have fun, but the reality of not doing what you're expected to do, the price is too high. So none of you at the midterm or final should write in your self-evaluation, "If I only had more time."
If you have just tuned in, you are listening to Ears on Art, produced at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I continue our visit with educator, artist, and world traveler Bob Nichols as he discusses the artist's relationship with his community.
So that brings us to another part of this story, which is relationship with community. When I started as a studio potter, I think I was on the cusp of a time frame that supported what I wanted to do. And I don't know where that is today. I know that at some point there were 32 potters in San Luis Obispo County, all trying to make a living. Now I count roughly 16. Things didn't exist. Downtown Mission Plaza didn't exist until the community rose up in response to the city council's denial of the student project, saying you really should close this off. The plaza was inherently a wonderful idea, taking the traffic right off in front of the mission, breaking that into a people space has always been one of the great joys. And I do remember the Sunset Magazine article preceding that, when their comment on San Luis Obispo was a great lost opportunity, meaning the creek flowing through town that was just a trash dump. And then it was all changed. It was huge transformation. And one of the members of the community that I must give the most accolades to is Linnea Phillips.
Yes!
And Linnea provided, along with her husband, who is a potter at that point, P.K. Phillips, who is also an architect on the Cal Poly campus, their kitchen became the network discussion. And out of those discussions came the proposals to do old-fashioned 4th of July, mm-hmm. and then old-fashioned Christmas. And then Linnea ended up being the events coordinator for the city, for the downtown plaza, and many other events emerged. And one of the things that gave me great pleasure, which was to take my wheel downtown, it was a marketing tool, obviously, to sit there and throw pots in front of my display as people were coming and going, and particularly to add names to the mailing list for future sales. Those events simply emerged out of air, out of people's belief of possibilities.
It wasn't that they necessarily got invented here, but it's impossible for any of us who have been here for a little while, and probably even newcomers, to think of the plaza as not being a place where interesting events are going to take place. The other thing that you did as part of your goal to make a living was that I believe you were one of the first to institute the process of a home sale. And it got to the point where we would be lined up down the street waiting for you to open the damn kiln. I think at first you were doing them twice a year, but it was a social event. It was a purchasing event. It was all of the things that were necessary for the community in its own way. So that was one innovation. The other was that you, and I'm not quite sure who the other three or four people were, started a local craft group. It was in response to what was not happening in this community. You want to talk about that?
Those are two separate issues. It was a logical extension of my experience at Cal Poly. There was an annual Christmas sale Roger Bailey instituted for the pottery. And I don't know how much you know of Engineering West at that time, but there was a pretty nice patio.
Yeah, that was my
space.
Classroom when I first arrived, so I lived there quite a while.
So that patio and all its heavy timbered benches became shelving, and that whole thing was set out. And that's where my experience that there was money to be made as a studio potter emerged, because I started in the spring and I participated in that sale, and I sold $301 worth of pots that Christmas. I hadn't even thought about that part. And so over the next couple of years, that mailing list emerged out of that experience. So holding a studio sale didn't seem all that novel a notion, but we had those names, and we mailed out a postcard, and people arrived, and they bought, and then it made sense to hold one in May, so or June 1st, whatever. So there were twice a year. And that was how the studio life was driven by this cycle. It took about 6 weeks to make enough work to fill the first firing, and that's called a bisque firing, the initial firing before glazes. That firing of bisqueware would generate 1.5 glaze kilns. So 2 bisque firings would equal 3 glaze kilns. And as you pointed out here with the pottery sales, opening the kiln was perceived as this marvelous event. You don't know quite what to expect. That was a wildly popular experience. That process unfolded as a natural extension of my original introduction at Poly to the pottery business. The Craft Coalition is another of those events that truly emerged around the dinner table at the Phillips household. Malou Mayo, Beryl Reichenberg, there was a group of women who were tied very specifically to textiles, but wildly adventurous in what they did. There were several of us as ceramic artists, and there were some really splendid woodworkers in the area. And so we formed the Craft Coalition, that was the initial name of
right.
it, and took that concept to the Arts Center, so that became part of a mix of broader artistic expression at the Arts Center, now the Art Museum, than it had existed previously.
And the other aspect of that was that those shows were juried.
First time ever locally.
The first time ever locally. Your purpose in that jurying?
We were talking about raising expectations for ourselves, for the community, and highlighting what was actually taking place already locally. So we always brought in jurors from outside the community, asked them to do as professional a job as they felt was appropriate. People working in clay, glass, wood, fiber, and metal, it set a standard for us all to aspire to. We hired people to come spend time in the community to teach us more professional ways to approach our work. We even brought the woman from the American Crafts Council in New York City to jury one of the shows. So I feel, as I'm thinking about reinventing myself as a studio potter, I don't know how much catching up I have to do, whether it's price structure or presentation, or whether I can just take my retirement subsidy and enjoy being a potter without worrying about that.
Well, I was thinking about price structure when you're talking about your $301 and wanting to say that wasn't just one piece.
I don't remember how many, but I'm sure it was close to 35.
Okay, so all these wonderful and sometimes frustrating experiences, but obviously a lot of great years lived and a lot of things happening both in the clay world and, as you say, the teaching. And what have been the ways, besides just analyzing the work and deciding that it's time for a shift or something, what helps inspire those shifts?
a splendid inquiry. One of the things that I trust is that the work is self-guiding. There'll be a point when it doesn't excite me. I'll look for excitement. What if I alter this, shift this? Another part of that is, for me, the environment in the classroom has led me to look all over the world for examples and be constantly shocked when I discover things that I've never encountered before. And then it gets really selfish. It gets back to, I'm going to make the stuff that speaks to me. I'm going to do things that have resonance at the core of my experience, and at the same time want to keep my eyes open to what others have done. And I want to bring all that into the classroom. And so when I travel now, I find myself looking through the view frame of my camera, formulating lectures for my students.
I remember hearing you describing what it was to be in the Southwest and New Mexico, I mean, that area, and how it changed a lot of your color sense of what you were doing with glazes. And that was...
My brother-in-law gave me a book, said, I think you'll enjoy this. It was Desert Solitaire, written by Edward Abbey. And it was his story of 2 years as a park ranger at the brand new Arches National Monument. And I had just read that when I received an invitation to spend a month as a stand-in guest artist at the Anderson Ranch in Snowmass, Colorado, for the School for the Hand and the Eye. And I sat down with a map and realized I could drive to Aspen and pick up these national parks all the way across Utah, and did. And when I got home, I was changed. And I was changed in the sense that everything I had done up to that point, so I started in 67, this is probably 73, 5 or 6 years into working with clay, lots of technical capabilities, but no sense of direction or purpose or reason to create. And my experience in that Utah landscape became, in fact, the source material. And I was able to negotiate trips back to Utah every other year for probably 10 or 12 years. The colors, the canyon formations, places like Bryce and their limestone formations, all of that led me to want to create work that was not pictures of that landscape. I wanted to feel when I unloaded the kiln like I had felt in that landscape. That led to changes in surface, in color, in glaze combinations, and it worked. It worked for me. And that's when the work took off in terms of invitations to teach, invitations to display, do workshops, provide more chances to get back to Utah. And every time I went to Utah, I came back with a new inspiration for a new set of color combinations. And it kept driving the work.
And now with Oaxaca?
Going, as I did recently, to the village of San Marcos, way up in the hills outside of Oaxaca, there's a phenomenon in Mexico which is unfamiliar to me anywhere else in the world, which is, this is my space, and I box in my space, and it's got a gate and a door, and people on the outside don't get to look into my world. And if you get permission, you go inside, and it's another world. Fortunate enough to meet a woman who's the owner of a gallery in Pasadena called the Folk Tree Gallery, and she focuses on imports from artisans in Mexico. And Rocky Bear and I met in January, and she finished our conversation by saying, I want to take you to Oaxaca. Well, she's been taking folks to Oaxaca for 20 years. She has relationships that I couldn't build in 10 years. Mm-hmm. And so we arrived there, and the first day, people are showing up at our hotel with their rugs or their jewelry or their wood carvings, and we haven't gone out yet. And so we're making our way around, and so the things that grab my attention, color. It's a subtropical climate. Wild plants are vibrant. Bougainvillea makes Santa Barbara blush. Flame trees, the flamboy, that's just a spectacular thing. The way people, as you move toward the equator, use color more intensely, more vibrantly than we do as we move toward the Arctic. Amongst my slideshows for my students is one called Colors of Oaxaca, because buildings are painted with a vibrancy. Mm-hmm. I think our house is going to change colors a bit here soon, too. We came back with paint chips off a building. I was gathering them for reference. Weavings, painted ceramics. I went with several technological questions about ceramics that I had resolved with folks, but we were in homes, we were in studios in a way that isn't like just walking around downtown Oaxaca and going into galleries. And the galleries are spectacular in Butte, but going out to where people do their work and seeing them and then having demonstrations for us. I saw things I can't even imagine how people are doing these techniques. But I have them on image base, so I can say, okay, I'm going to fast forward and just watch that pot change. Another thing that really has captivated me is the role of the Catholic Church integrated into an indigenous society within thousands of years of tradition of deities, of figures representing gods which stood for everything. And it's just this richness, and the sculpture that grew out of that is spectacular. And it's all done in clay or stone, and to a lesser extent, it was done in everything else. But either the gold was ripped off by the Spanish, or the wood is decomposed, or the fiber has decomposed, and so we don't get to see that so much. But for me, I told you about the vessel, the boat. Well, there are an endless array of these kind of symbols which are wonderful devices for narrative. There's a thing called a milagro. That means miracle. Mm-hmm. But the physical manifestation of a milagro is a small symbol. It might be a symbol for eyes, for heart, for feet, for a truck, for a pregnancy. And those milagros are fascinating. And I would, of course, want to hold them up to the microphone and say, look at this one. So that's really captured my attention, and I've been thinking about ways to sculpt my versions of the symbolism of significance in my life and how I can incorporate that in the imagery in my work. I've struggled with the fact that the iconography of all of these rich previous cultures is really appealing, but I don't own that. And and a major problem with those images is appropriation. So I'm loving the idea of this symbolism as a vehicle to express my own ideas, but not using their symbols, not using their material goods. But I sure love staring at them. I think that's all my work is about, is my narrative, working on what is the story I'm trying to tell myself about who I am and where I am.
I think, Bob Nichols, that it's been a pretty remarkable story. I know you've been sharing it for years with students and friends.
Yeah, Bob, this has been an amazing journey. I've thoroughly enjoyed it.
Do we have to stop? I thank you.
Well, you're most welcome.
To our delight, this conversation lasted close to 2 hours. We will post the unabridged version on the website in the KCBX archives in the next couple of weeks. And if you missed last week's part of this interview with artist Bob Nichols, it also is in the archives. Our guest today has been Bob Nichols, local artist and teacher. I am Chrissy Hewitt, and you have been listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly feature of the audio magazine Issues and Ideas. Stephen DeLuque and I produce Ears on Art for KCBX Public Radio. And we thank you so much for listening.